If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us again today. I am the Porkmeister. You are listening to Life on Planet Porky. And Life on Planet Porky wouldn't be anything without the star of the show. And that is the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, who, of course, joins us now. Leslie Ann, what's it like being back in the real world? We spoke in our last podcast about your journeys to the north. And may I just say, a journey to the north might one of these days involve you going to Scotland, because this very evening, as people are listening to this podcast on day one of it being released, Scotland are playing England. What do you think about that?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? I mean, I love Scotland. I spent a lot of time in Scotland when I was a child. We always used to go up to the lochs when we were little with my mum and dad.
Did you ever meet the monster?
We went looking for it lots of times. Yeah, my dad used to tease the life out of us about Loch Ness Monster if we were naughty, you know. And yeah, we always went to Loch Ness and had a look. In fact, I've paddled in Loch Ness, but never seen the monster. I used to go up to the Isle of Mull every August with my family when the kids were small.
Yes.
Beautiful beaches up there. And we stayed in a manse opposite, facing the Isle of Skye. So you could stand on the beach at sundown and look at the Isle of Skye. I always said that looking at the Isle of Skye was infinitely preferable to being on the Isle of Skye, which is quite boring when you're there.
But I totally agree. The view, you know, over the sea to Skye. I was very disappointed when they built a bridge, because, you know, the most romantic thing is, was it Bonnie Prince Charlie escaping in his boat over the sea to Skye?
Is that the Kyle of Loch Alsh, the one that the train goes over?
Well, I'm not sure, to be honest.
Might be somewhere else. But I've remembered, stored that away in the back of my mind. But yes, I love Scotland. I love Scottish culture. Mm. My best friend in all the world, who sadly left us about nearly 6 years ago now, Jim Diamond, he had the massive hit in 1984, I Should Have Known Better. Do you remember that song?
I should have known better than a girl like you. And if everything I do. That's a Beatles song, by the way.
That's the Beatles song. Yeah, no. He had the other one. And I'm not going to sing, because we will get complaints. Everyone knows who Jim Diamond is.
Yeah.
Anyway, he famously went on television all over the networks and thanked his fans for giving him a number one, his first ever number one as a solo artist. But he also said, I don't want you to buy my record next week. I want you to buy the Band-Aid single and get that to number one so that we can raise money for the starving in Ethiopia. And that's what happened. And he literally threw away his own hit for the sake of the starving millions. Yeah, that was the kind of guy he was. And I miss him tremendously. Another friend of mine lives in Glasgow called Rab Noakes. He worked
not
with
Rapsy Nesbitt by any chance, no?
No, but Radnix, he's another great friend of mine. Yeah. And of course, I've been up there to do it's called I Write, AYEWRITE, the I Write Literary Festival in Glasgow, which I've appeared at. Thanks to Rab. So I love Scotland. It's very difficult, isn't it? I'm not strictly speaking English, so I tend not to root for the English unless, you know, we are playing another country, and I just said we. So obviously I do identify as partly English. But being primarily Welsh, I can stand back from it a little bit and sort of root for them both, I think.
Yeah.
Because it's all Britain at the end of the day, isn't it?
Oh, I totally agree. I love Scotland, and I've not seen enough of it. I mean, you know, I've talked before about this epiphany I've had during lockdown where I don't really want to work every day now. I've always wanted to work every day all my life. You know the sort of person I am, and I've always enjoyed it. But I'm going to take more time off now, and I'm going to go to places like the Highlands and the Islands. I'm going to go to the Norfolk Broads. But Scotland, I have a particular sort of love for. I want to go to the Shetland Isles. I want to see what it's like there, because I've covered stories in Scotland, mostly always to do with football matches. And when you see a crowd of Scottish football fans in their tartan, you know, wearing their national garb and flying the national flags, it's a motivating force, which we simply don't have in England. The Welsh, your people, they've got a culture, you know, they've got a national dress, they've got a history of song and all that kind of stuff. And Scotland have got their own culture, and it's one that they're missing in this country. But there we are.
Are you saying that the English don't have any culture?
Well, I'm saying that we've been around for so long and we've done so much, we can't put our finger on one particular piece of culture which people can identify us with.
Well, could I suggest maybe Shakespeare or Charles Dickens?
That's too far away. It's too long gone. And you can't walk around with a Shakespeare mask on your face to indicate you're English. But you can walk around with tartan scarves and in a kilt and a tam o'shanter and all that kind of stuff. And similarly, the Welsh, you know, they can walk around with red and white scarves, and they can pin a leek to their to the lapel of their jacket and all that kind of stuff, and daffodils and all that. And I don't think we've got that in England. But anyway, look.
Well, no. I want to pursue this because this is very interesting. So if we don't have a national symbol of some kind, don't you think we ought to have one? And what would it be?
It would be a rose. It'd be the English rose, which in fact appears on the shirt of the English rugby team. But for the English football team, we have the three lions. And the three lions has always been a bit of a joke. I mean, it goes back to Richard the Lionheart and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? But we are nevertheless the three lions. I'm not knocking my country. I'm a very proud Englishman, and I love everything that we do and the values we brought to the world. It's just the identification of the English is sometimes a bit blurred, particularly as, you know, the Union Jack and the flag of St. George are now kind of one and the same, and nobody quite knows. Whereas the Scottish satire and the Welsh flag, you know, red and white with the dragon on it, are completely distinctively different. Let me talk to you.
Hang on. I would have said that the Union Jack was as distinctive as both the Scottish satire and the Welsh dragon. I would have
You're totally right. But what we've done is we've taken that overcoat off. We've taken that Union Jack overcoat off because it got hijacked by extremist political factions.
Well, that's very true, yes.
Yeah, and we're frightened now to take it back on. However, Ms. Jones, because you are one of the world's leading biographers of rock stars, may ask you about a couple of you've talked to us about your friend Mr. Diamond, but can I talk to you about some Scottish pop stars that I know? Marty Pellow of Wet Wet Wet. I went to a reception once hosted by Bill Kenwright. I call Mr. Kenwright my friend. I call him the chairman. He was putting on a production in the West End. Marty Pellow was leading it, the lead singer. Where I find him a very, very nice guy. He was, of course, lead singer of the group that produced I Feel It In My Fingers, I Feel It In My Toes. You know that song, obviously.
Yeah, you know that was a cover version, don't you?
Yes, it was first done by a bloke with a funny name in the 1950s, a very distinctive name. What was his name?
A little bit later than that. Was Reg Presley of the Trolls.
Reg Presley, exactly, a distinctive name, no less. And that was in the 60s, was it?
Yeah, he used to come to our Scribblers' lunches as well. And I remember
that. Reg Presley?
Yeah, he did. Oh. I remember very clearly the very last time he came. Yeah. He used to come around with a minder because he wasn't very stable on his feet by that stage. Mm-hmm. And he had a walking stick and he always left early. He was always very friendly when he was there and spoke to everyone and was lovely.
Yeah.
And this particular lunch, it was in June.
Yeah.
He stood at the doorway and he waved his walking stick around his head to everyone in the room. And he said, "See you, folks." Mm. And I thought to myself, we are never going to see him again. And he died very shortly after that. Very sad. But I just kind of knew, I had a feeling that was it, you know. But what a wonderful guy. And what an amazing song.
Oh, just a fantastic song. And but I thought Marty Pello gave it justice. I thought it was a lovely version of it, you know, wet, wet, wet and all that kind of stuff. Did you ever come across Marty Pello or Wet, Wet, Wet? They were pretty huge at one time.
Yeah, they were. And I remember going to the showcase gig that they gave at Ronnie Scott's. It was about 6 o'clock one evening.
Ronnie Scott's, of course, in Soho, yes?
Yes, I forget the record company. I want to say that it was Warner's or Sony or even CBS. It might have been as far back as that. Yeah. But they gave this showcase where they invite journalists, as you know, and just media people to come along and sort of see them perform a few numbers for the first time and to launch their album, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And Marty Pello, I remember standing there looking at him thinking, this boy has more charisma in his little finger than the whole of the Scottish nation. He just was mesmerizing. Really? And I thought to myself, they could actually dispense with the band. They could launch this guy as a solo artist and he'll be the next Elvis Presley. Ooh. And in fact, that was suggested to him so many times over the years. Mm-hmm. He was offered all kinds of contracts, all kinds of deals and favors to ditch the band and go solo, and he never would. Mm-hmm. And of course, eventually, once the star waned, he did. And he became a bit of an actor. He fell from grace for a while. He became a heroin addict.
And after he got into his solo acting career?
Not sure of the timing. I wouldn't want to specify that.
Okay.
But I remember sort of not hearing about him for years and years. And then I went to see a revival production of Evita at the Dominion Theatre. It was one of those summer productions, you know, a sort of short-term thing.
Yeah.
And he was playing Che Guevara in that, and he was astonishing. Wow.
I think I remember the image with the Che Guevara beret on and the star on it and all that. Yeah, I remember the image, and he looked very like Che Guevara, as I recall.
Yeah, well, you probably remember David Essex in the original production starred Elaine Page as Evita.
I'm going to make you a star.
Yeah, but that song wasn't in that musical.
Yeah, that was David Essex.
It's a bit of crossover going on here. David Essex was amazing in that part, of course.
Yeah.
But
Marty
Pello gave him a run for his money, I would say.
Last time I saw David Essex was in you won't believe this, in an edition of Heartbeat. So it must have been the kind of 90s. And golly, in my disco days in the 80s, right, David Essex was such a fantastically good-looking man, you know, with tumbling black curly hair and not so good and all that. And he appeared in this episode of Heartbeat TV show, very popular in the sort of early 90s on a Sunday night, 8 o'clock, as a bald-headed traveller, you know, who turned up in Aidensfield. And when you see somebody 10 years on, you know, and they're not the iconic image they were, it's a bit of a shock, isn't it?
Well, it is. And this is the plight of the beautifully good-looking young man, of course
it is.
Because you start life with that as an advantage, great personal beauty and charm and charisma. It's only going to go one way. And if you think of any of the great heartthrobs, the young'uns from way back, look at somebody like Roger Taylor, the drummer in Queen, who was so good-looking, you couldn't look at him. I used to sort of cower in the corner thinking, I can't even set eyes on that guy.
Did your heart literally melt and your knees go weak?
No, not in that way. But no, definitely not in that way. But I did used to think, you are too good looking to look at.
Really?
And of course, you look at him now and it's all gone off the side. So the really good looking ones, losing their looks is much more dramatic than if they're just sort of ordinary looking. In fact, a lot of men grow into their looks as they get older. And it's the same thing with women, by the way. The very, very beautiful women who start life as gorgeous young girls, they tend to lose their looks much more dramatically than girls of ordinary looks.
I look at early pictures, even today, when I don't go seeking them, but you see them on telly sometimes, you know, in some programmes. Gina Lollobrigida, Raquel Welch, Elizabeth Taylor. Crikey, when they were in their 20s, I mean, I don't know how I would have been able to live, you know, without, you know, having a part of the beauty that they had and all that kind of stuff. And then you're absolutely right. It's a terrible thing sort of 50 years later to have to realise you're looking at the same person. I mean, growing old can be very cruel, can't it?
Well, it can. Did you read Britt Eklund talking in the papers recently about all the, cosmetic surgery that she's had?
Yes.
And she said that if she could wind back time, she wouldn't have any of the Botox or the surgical procedures that she'd had, because it hasn't made her look better. It's just made her look weird. And she's the first one to say that. Yeah. And there was also, if you remember, a series, a long-running series called Dynasty in the way back when, or
of
Dynasty,
course I do.
As we used to call it.
Yeah.
There was Linda Gray, but the other one, the very beautiful blonde.
Yes.
Linda somebody.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. She was the wife of
Crystal.
The main star.
She played Crystal.
Yeah, that's right.
Crystal Carrington.
Yes.
Linda someone.
Yes.
And she went a similar path. She had endless operations on her face to try and boost her looks as they were fading. And in the end, she looked like a freak, like the Bride of Wildenstein. And she used to tour America giving lectures about why women should resist cosmetic surgery and to just go with what nature is doing with our faces and our figures. And there's a lot of wisdom in that, because there's nothing we can do to change it. We might as well live with it.
No, I totally agree. I've got to bring this up while I can still get in my head. Dynasty. One of the other actresses in it was Emma Sams, right?
Yes.
All right. And she's British. And just like Joan Collins, she broke into the American, you know, higher class soap opera stuff. And guess what I discovered? I've told you that this week GB News launched. I've done my first couple of pieces on GB News. I'm very happy to have done. You know, it's a great new station, all that kind of stuff. But one of the main presenters, and I can't actually remember his name, has come from Sky after working for Sky for 23 years. And when I looked at his profile, he lives with or is married to Emma Sams.
No way.
Yeah, honestly.
That's very interesting. Yeah. Well, do you remember this? When I was on the Daily Mail in the way back when, my boss, my showbiz editor, had an affair with Emma Sams and left his wife for her.
Really?
No, that was a guy called Peter Sheridan. Do you remember?
Of course I know Peter. Peter was a long-standing West Coast LA correspondent, wasn't he?
That's right. He's still there and he's still doing the same gig.
Yeah.
Pretty useful journalist, actually. But he left his wife, Susan, for Emma Sams, and they both wrote about it. It was gripping stuff.
Right.
Because Peter would write a piece about, I am a showbiz reporter. My beat is a wild one. And he was almost making excuses for the fact that, you know, why wouldn't he meet a film star and fall in love? Because that's what happens. And then Susan hit back with a load of very nitty-gritty detail about Peter leaving her for this actress.
Right.
And then in the end, they got back together and they had two beautiful daughters. So,
Am I going mad, or was Peter Sheridan the first man I ever met who told me he was a vegan and I didn't know what a vegan was? Does that make any sense?
I can't remember him being vegan. I stayed at his place, actually, in LA and stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't remember the vegan bit, but it might just have gone over my head.
It may be somebody else. By the way, when you stay with friends in LA, particularly in the 80s and early 90s, you know, you'd fly up to America and they'd say, oh, come stay. The most amazing thing was we're all working journalists in Fleet Street, and we go out to LA to find that our colleagues out there have all got a blinking swimming pool.
I know, isn't it galling? Yeah, every single one of them.
And you think, hang on, I've got this wrong somewhere. Why have they got a swimming pool?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of skullduggery and shenanigans go on. But
Do you remember that Neil Diamond song about LA's fine, the sun shines most of the time?
I said.
But there's one line which says, rents are low and palm trees grow. And it was much cheaper to live in California than it was to live in New York.
In those days, because it was a bit of a car park, wasn't it? It was a desert car park.
Exactly.
You had to have a car and you had to be able to drive because you couldn't get anywhere otherwise.
Well, to start off with, there's no such place as Los Angeles. It's just a collection of suburbs, isn't it? Like Santa Monica and Venice Beach and all that kind of stuff. And secondly, you're so right. When they built it, they didn't build any pavements. So you can't, there's no sidewalks. You can't walk anywhere, can you?
No, apart from sort of Beverly Hills, you know, where the main shopping centre...
Exactly, where's the flourished. Shopping centre? Or the broadwalks, that's why they're called broadwalks, on the edge of the beach and all that. But you can't actually walk between anywhere. But what I found fantastic about that sort of life out there was that we didn't know in this country what was going on there. So I go out there, and I'm working in New York, based in New York, and I have to go over to LA. And I know this sounds pathetic now, 40 years on, but I go and see some correspondent. I think it was John What's-His-Name, who worked for The Telegraph.
Well, that narrows it down, doesn't it?
Yeah, it narrows it down enormously. Or it might have been, it was either John What's-His-Name for The Telegraph, or it was Eddie What's-His-Name for Daily Mail or something like that. You know. But anyway, point of the story is, they all had swimming pools, and they like to boast about it. So I go around and see him, and we're on a job together, you know, and I've come over from New York, and we're going to make a great series out of this or something like that. And he says, come on, let's go and have a swim. I said, yeah, it'd be lovely. You know. So I'm standing in the middle of the swimming pool. This is a pathetic story 40 years on.
Just realised.
Yes, I have just realised, yeah. And all of a sudden, you know, John What's-His-Name's wife comes out of the, you know, the house, you know, it's a bit like a Spanish villa, and says, oh, Mike, there's a call for you here from London. I said, oh, okay, thanks. So I take a cordless phone. And we didn't have cordless phones in England at that time. Do you see what I mean? It was unbelievable.
You took the call in the pool, I bet.
This is exactly what I'm saying. So,
oh, God.
So she handed me the phone, and it was a guy called John Ellison, who was the foreign editor. I can hear some action at your end.
Yeah, they're coming for me. The police are on their way. Yeah, you better make this quick.
That's right. They're coming to take me away. Ha ha. They're coming to take me away. Yeah. Anyway, so I take the phone. And John Ellison, who was, you know, pretty much in his dotage, certainly his 60s, and hadn't caught up with life, said, "Now, Michael, you know, I want to tell you this. I want to tell you this on this story you're on." I said, "Yeah, that's great, John, yeah." He said, "Right, now, get a pad and a pen and write this down." And I said, "I can't, John." He said, "What do you mean you can't?" I said, "I'm sorry, I'm standing in the middle of Dougie's swimming pool." It was Dougie, actually, I've just remembered, yeah, not John, yeah. I'm standing in, he said, "Are you trying to take the piss out of me?" I said, "No, John, I'm." He said, "Well, how are you talking to me?" I said, "Well, I'm on a phone that doesn't have a line. It's called a cordless phone. Get out of that swimming pool and ring me back." You know, it was all this kind of stuff. They didn't understand.
Well, I kind of take his point, really. If you're supposed to be on the job, you know, working, he doesn't want to hear that you're standing in the middle of someone's pool, probably with a beer in one hand and, you know, a nice little pair of sunny G's on and the whole bit. Yeah. You're supposed to be working, man.
But there was no other way I could explain to him why I couldn't get hold of a pad and a pen and write it down. But anyway, glorious days when all these loads of people went out to LA in those days, LA in LA.
And, yeah, that's who I was in those days.
Exactly. And you'd have met so many of them, and they were chancers. But some of them stuck around for 10 years, you know, and had a reasonable living, all that kind of stuff. Just getting back, sorry, because I've got to tell you.
Hang on, did that story actually have a point?
Yeah, the point of it was that we used to live great lives if we worked in America. You know, it was pretty fantastic stuff. And you were talking about, you know, Liz Taylor and all that kind of stuff. Those are all the stories we went over there to do. But no, sorry, just before we finish this segment of the podcast, just getting back briefly to the Scottish thing, because, of course, we ran out of time for me to tell you. I worked with Alan Brazil for many years. Alan Brazil, I've told this story before, but it's now in context, was at school with the man who was lead singer of the group, and he married Patsy Kensit. What was his name?
Jim Kerr of Simple Minds.
Well done. And his mate, Charlie Birchall. They were all in the same class together. Another great Scottish success story.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. And I have to say, Miss Jones, that Life on Planet Porky is always cool and it's always, you know, laid back. But blimey, I'm glad I'm not living on life on planet Earth at the moment. This week has been so blinking hot, it's worn me down.
The asphalt is sizzling, isn't it? I mean, everything's melting. Yeah. It's a funny thing because, you know, with the whole masks and now sunglasses and everybody's got this ensemble on, you can't tell who anybody is anymore.
No. Well, in my case, many would say the fact that I've been walking around with a face mask for quite a long time has been a benefit to society, if not for me. And I will concede on that. Although, funny enough, I've done more television this week than I've done radio, so I must have a face for the old TV. Miss Jones, I want to talk to you about a woman who made a huge impression on your life, and you'll have seen last week, like I did, the magazine called Weekend exclusive. For Linda, it was all about the animals. In a magical new family cookbook, Paul, Mary and Stella McCartney tell of Linda's vegetarian legacy and how warmth and love radiated from her table. What a fantastic sort of legacy to leave so many years after she's gone.
Definitely. I read that piece. It was in the Mail, Saturday Mail supplement, Weekend.
Yeah.
I read the piece. It was an extract. So even though the piece said by Paul McCartney, he didn't write that specially for the magazine. It was taken from the book.
Yeah, but I think he gave his blessing to it, didn't he? That was the whole point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the book looks rather good, actually. The recipes look very advanced and quite intricate. Yeah. I'll definitely be buying it. I was a big fan of Linda McCartney. She had a terrible press. Yeah. People really didn't like her. They would actually write this kind of thing in newspapers back then. Yeah. What do you call a dog with wings? Linda McCartney. Yeah. You would not get away with that now.
You should have got away with it in those days. It's disgusting. And the point is that, you know, that there were 100 million women around the world who resented Linda McCartney for marrying Paul. Because he was the Beatle, you know, he's one of the four Beatles, obviously. And the fact that she'd already been married and had a child, they all said, oh, why has he gone for, you know, used goods and all this kind of stuff? It was horrendous.
As if any of them was ever going to get anywhere near him. You know, they were just being unrealistic and rude. But it all was water off a duck's back. She was wonderfully funny about it. And she said things like, if they're having a go at me, they're not having a go at somebody else. So, you know, I have a purpose in life. And I really admired her for that. But she was at the vanguard of the vegetarian movement. The family has kept her honor and her business alive. Mm. And what I think one of the most wonderful things about this is Paul is remarried, has been for about 10 years to Nancy.
Remarried twice since Linda, of course.
Well, that's true, but we disregard Heather. Yeah. The fact that they have Nancy's blessing to do all of this in honor of Paul's late wife, I think is wonderful.
Well, I think it's absolutely remarkable, honestly. Nancy Pelosi, I think, is the name of his third wife, isn't it?
No.
Oh, no, Nancy Pelosi is the Speaker in the House of...
I'm afraid she is, yes.
Yeah.
I forget her original surname.
Yeah, so do I. But you're absolutely right here. I saw this, and there's five pages about Paul McCartney, pictured with his family, beautiful pictures of Linda, the kids when they were young, and all the farm animals when they lived on the Mull of Kintyre and all that, all so warm and so beautifully familial. And I'm thinking, I wonder if Paul's current wife has any sort of envy factor about how clearly happy he was in his life with Linda, his wife of 30 years.
Well, you can't, as it's the old saying goes, you can't envy a dead wife, can you? She's gone.
Yeah. Well, yes, but I mean, that's a bit trite, if you don't mind me saying. I mean, the point is, if he's happy to see these five or six pages, actually, as I'm looking at it, all dedicated to his wife, surely that would hurt his current wife, wouldn't it?
No, not at all. It obviously has her blessing. It's like when he goes out to do concert tours nowadays, I've always gone to every single tour and never miss it because the opportunities are dwindling. He won't be doing it for too much longer. He always dedicates a section of the show to Linda and pictures of her flash up behind him on the giant screen and so on. And Nancy is always in the audience. So she's obviously very relaxed about it and very confident in herself and her relationship with him.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Of course, it's not Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi is the woman who hated Donald Trump and ripped up his State of the Union speech, do you remember, standing behind him in Congress and threw it in the air. Congress, a wonderful building. just on Mr. McCartney, Paul McCartney, Sir Paul McCartney, because obviously our millions of subscribers and listeners to this podcast wouldn't like us to spend too little time talking about the Beatles for obvious reasons.
But
I saw this piece again about Paul. He's talked to some podcast and he said that when he gets a problem now, whether he's writing lyrics for a song or whether he's, you know, got some business decision to make, he says to himself, what would John have done? And I find that incredibly moving because I think it's a fantastic illustration of the closeness those guys must have had to have created some of the greatest songs in history.
Well, they knew each other as small boys. They grew up together. They experienced rags to riches together. They both lost their mothers at a very young age, all of which bonded them so inextricably closely. And it's completely understandable that he would still think of John and even talk to him in his mind about how he should solve something. I know exactly how he feels because I lost my father nearly 2 years ago, but my father was my inspiration.
You had a very long life with your father. Of course, he was inspirational to you. And of course, you took your values in life from your father, who's an outstanding individual himself. But you didn't lose him when you were 40.
No, I didn't. I had him for a long, long time. And in some ways, it's a lot harder to lose them when you have them so long. But my father was a great champion of what I do, and he would always be there with great advice. And so I still think, what would Dad say? What would Dad advise me to do? And I act accordingly. Somebody else who I think about every single day, even though he's been gone many, many years, is the DJ Roger Scott, who was a star at Capital Radio and Radio One and so on. He was in with all the rock stars, you know, they loved him. He was the DJ's DJ. Yeah. And I often think to myself, how would Roger handle this? What would he say in response to this? And the inspiration comes. So whether that's in our imaginations or whether we genuinely are tapping into that person's psyche as it was when they were on Earth, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
No, I totally agree. The greatness of Lennon McCartney will be spoken about in 200 years' time in the same way that we speak of, I don't know, Schubert, all the great composers of the 17 and 1800s and all that.
Mozart, Beethoven, the lot of them,
Thank you for naming them all because obviously that's all it is. But, you know, I'm a Beatles bore, as you know, because whenever we sit down, as we're going to do again very soon in a bar in Fleet Street, that's all I want to talk about. But no.
It doesn't bore me, not 1 second.
No, of course not. But
By the way, anybody who's further interested and who's intrigue is piqued by our constant talk of the Beatles, there's quite a decent biography out at the moment about John Lennon, which I would love them to read.
I've got a copy on my table here, Who Killed John Lennon, the paperback version by Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, and it's a wonderful read. I've read it twice myself.
Thank you. The paperback's out now, so all rush and buy one.
Absolutely, get out there. Just to finish this subject, I had a mate in newspapers called, I've forgotten his name now.
he was John, Jonathan, or he was no, Edward, no, or maybe no, he was no, Dougie.
No, honestly, I turned up to work for the Birmingham Evening Mail as a very young reporter. I'd left the Chester Chronicle and I went to Newcastle because I wanted to work on the Newcastle Evening Chronicle because I loved the Northeast. I'd done my training up there for 6 months and I loved the Geordie culture and I loved the Geordie landscape. I loved going to Tynemouth and watching the sea, you know, the waves piling on the beach and all that. And I just loved the attitude of the people up there. They had a terrible time during the Depression of 1929, really, really hit badly, worse than any other part of the country, probably apart from South Wales, you know, your country. But they kind of grew up to, you know, fight back and get on with all that. I love the attitude. So I wanted to go to Newcastle, work there, Newcastle Evening Chronicle, very, very proud to be a reporter there. But they had terrible industrial problems. There was always a strike. If it wasn't the reporters, it was the van drivers or the printers. And so I saw an advert in the UK Press Gazette and went to the Birmingham Evening Mail. And I was, you know, I was delighted to have been taken on there. But I thought I was going to be working in Birmingham, huge city and huge newspaper in those days. And they asked me to work in the Redditch district office. And Redditch is a little town on the Worcestershire-Warwickshire border, a lovely little town. And I went there. And then I met my my mate who arrived on the same day, called Ian Sangster. Remembered his name. but I always called him Sangy. Okay, he was just a smashing lad. He had the same attitude to life as me. So we'd finish work at sort of 2:30, 3 o'clock. On worked on an evening newspaper. We started at, you know, 7 a.m. to get the today's stories out, and then after midday we were doing the stories for tomorrow's edition, all that kind of stuff. And then we'd go to we'd jump in our cars. We were paid well. By comparison to people in those days, and we jumped into our Vauxhall Vivas and we went off to the local sports centre and hired a tennis court to keep ourselves fit and play tennis, okay? And, you know, we had all the white gear and that kind of stuff. We usually played for about 25 minutes till we heard this rattle of a shutter opening, and it was the bar opening in the inside the changing room, sports centre. So we packed up after 25 minutes, went in there, and then got absolutely bladderated for the rest of the night, you know. And
Sangy, and that was your fitness regime.
Yes, that was our fitness regime. Yeah, yeah, definitely, yeah. And then we'd actually leave our cars there and get a taxi, and we'd go off to some pub in Warwickshire or something, have a great night. He was a smashing guy. So anyway, we were probably about, I don't know, 23, 24 in those days. And I then moved on to other things. I joined the Daily Express and all that. I got a card from him some 10 or 12 years later. We were still in touch. And it said, still alive at 35, come to my 35th birthday party, which was still in Redditch. He'd stayed with the Birmingham Evening Mail and had, you know, gone up the ranks. And I think he was like deputy news editor or something like that. And then I got a call 2 days later, and Sangy had come out the shower. And his girlfriend, he always had a different girlfriend, he never got married, was in the kitchen making the spag bol, and Sangy walked in and had a glass of whiskey in one hand and a cigarette going on the other. He smoked about 40 fags a day. And as he stood there talking to his girlfriend, he just fainted. And he had a hemorrhage in the back of his head and he died just like that.
Just, oh my God, yeah. Just dropped down dead, like Christian Eriksen might have done.
Like Christian Eriksen might have done. Christian Eriksen's problem was, of course, a heart situation. But I think the one in the back of your head is called an anema or something.
And no, it's an aneurysm.
An aneurysm. Well done. Thank you very much. And he literally just fainted, just collapsed, and he was dead before he hit the floor.
And he was only 35?
35, yeah.
My God, and that's awful.
Yeah, it was absolutely shocking. And I still talk to him. You know, I still honestly, I still miss him terribly, because we'd have grown, you know, I knew we grew up together for about 12 years, but we'd have grown into our dotage and middle age and all that, you know what I mean? And yeah. and he would have still been my best friend. The total irony of it was that both his parents were doctors. And so when we went to the funeral, went to the wake afterwards, I couldn't believe how his mother and father, both doctors, had completely accepted the situation. You know, the grief was not apparent, which I found very odd. But then I thought, maybe because they're doctors, they understand that this sort of thing can happen.
I'm not sure it's that, although I understand your point. I was very composed at my father's funeral, and I could not have been more distraught when he died.
Yeah.
I think the fact that it takes quite a long time for a funeral to actually occur, you have to wait in some cases up to a month to get a slot, to book a chapel or a church or whatever, and for all the arrangements to be made. And by that time, you haven't exactly come to terms with it, but you are across it.
Yes.
And you know that you have to be dignified on the day for the sake of everybody else.
Yes.
And certainly that, I was determined. I woke up that day, I put my makeup on, dressed nicely, and I thought to myself, I am not letting the side down, and Dad would not be happy with me if I blubbed all over this. I have to be composed.
Cool.
And I was. So I think you can talk yourself into it, and that's probably what that guy's parents did that day.
Yeah, maybe. It's, you know, it's so sad looking back, because I didn't lose a child, obviously, but I left a, I lost a guy, and I just wonder how, you know, his career would have developed and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, look, these things happen. I know you're not a great TV viewer necessarily, Leslie Ann. You've got lots of other things to do, and you're a, you know, terrifically successful journalist. But there's been a fantastic programme on starring Sean Bean, who you may have interviewed over the years, I'm not sure.
I haven't ever come across him, actually, but he's not a bad actor, is he?
I think he's terrific. And he was in a thing called Time with Stephen Graham. And I'm sure you might have interviewed Stephen Graham, because Stephen Graham's only sort of emerged in the last 10 years, you know, when you've been writing books. And I, but what a pair of, excuse me, powerful actors. And it was called Time because it's one of these classic stories encompassed by Jimmy McGovern, the writer, you know, who is... His control of detail was incredible. Sean Bean plays a teacher, a middle-class teacher, who goes to jail because he's got a drink problem, like a lot of middle-class people have, and he knocks a man down on his bicycle when he's driving home when he's drunk. And in panic, he flees. But when he gets home, he realises that he shouldn't have done that. He rings the police and hands himself in, and he gets 4 years in jail. Stephen Graham is a prison warder in this jail. And my God, the sheer illustration of what it's like to be in jail, drugs, brutality, beatings up, people being, you know, forced into suicide. It was horrendous. And sorry, I know you want to speak. It, one of my worst fears, I swear to you, is ending up in a situation like that and being incarcerated with animals.
Okay, well, it happens more frequently than we know.
It does.
I think most people, right-thinking people like us, worry about this kind of thing all the time, because you need not necessarily be drunk. You could take your eye off the ball for a second, or somebody could leap out in front of you when you're driving your car, or a cyclist might ride into your path, and you can still be found guilty of manslaughter when it wasn't your fault.
Yes, that's true.
So I think this is a very frightening thing. Why would an innocent person be arrested and convicted? Well, look, some people they're coerced, I think, into giving false confessions under police interrogation. That kind of thing happens all the time. Yeah. Faulty eyewitness identification. Some people are done for DUI, drunk under the influence or drugged under the influence, when they're on prescription drugs, for example, which are too strong for them. Domestic violence accusations that are actually false, all this kind of thing. I think it's a terrifying thing that hangs over all our heads, a bit like a sword of Damocles.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And in contrast to that, it was very powerful, by the way. You know, if you've got time, it's only three episodes, so you can get it on.
Is it very violent, though? Because I wouldn't like it if it is.
It's very frightening. In one scene, a bunch of, you know, thugs within the prison, thug prisoners, burst into Sean Bean's jail cell. They get hold of his legs. They roll his trousers up, take his shoes and socks off.
How is Susan Shocks?
And they pour turps all over his feet. And unless he does what they tell him to do, they're going to set fire to his feet. And they, you know, remind him, we set fire to your feet, you'll never walk again. I mean, the horrifying brutality of that happening to a middle-class teacher. You see what I mean?
You've got to stay out of prison. I mean, hook or crook, you've got to stay out of prison.
No, it's absolutely true. You know, you read lots of stories about, trouble is with prison in this country. It's like a holiday camp. Ooh, it's not if you watch this, honestly. It certainly isn't. Did you ever have any doings with Anthea Turner?
I'm afraid so. I've come across Anthea quite a lot over the years. She's actually engaged to be married to an old friend of mine at the moment. A guy called Mark Armstrong, who used to be very big on the London club scene, sort of running clubs and that kind of stuff. And they are, they're both 61, I suppose, now. I know that Mark is, and they're the same age. She was a bit too ambitious for her boots, wasn't she, really?
Is that fair? I mean, Eamon Holmes gave her a hard time, called her Princess Tippy Toes and all that. She's too emotional, all that. But I'm surprised that you are saying that she was a bit overambitious. Women have to be overambitious to break the glass ceiling in broadcasting, don't they?
I suppose so. But what I always thought about her, because she starts... Hang on a minute. I'm so sorry.
Come on.
She started out on Blue Peter. Well, fair enough. You know, lots of people start out on Blue Peter, but then she was on GMTV Jolie for a couple of years. But of course, in those days, there wasn't as much television as there is now. And back in that time, if you were on telly, you were a major star. But she left GMTV in 1996. That's a quarter of a century ago. Mm. And who cares, really? Things have moved on hugely. She was replaced by Fiona Phillips. Yeah. Anthea became more famous for her affairs. She stole Grant Bovey off his wife, if you remember, and then they got married, and then he cheated on her, so she dumped him. She did Celebrity Big Brother, and she did Hell's Kitchen. Yeah. She's no Holly Willoughby, is what I'm trying to say. And I think it's a little bit rich of her to still be chasing a major television career on not very much experience. There are lots of people who are infinitely better qualified than Anthea Turner.
She was on the couch on Breakfast TV with Eamon Holmes. That's the top
job. For two years.
Well, most of us don't do it for 2 minutes. That's what I'm saying. I mean, I thought she had a successful career. On the Grant Bovey thing, by the way, that was one of, tabloid newspapers' greatest hashes, I think. Because Anthea Turner steals Grant Bovey. Was Grant Bovey's wife called Delia or something, or Delia?
Della.
Della. I remember this so well.
Hang on, wasn't she married to the radio presenter, TV
Peter
presenter?
Powell. Peter Powell, wasn't it?
No. Anthea was married to Peter Powell.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. But
Della. It's Della I'm talking about. Yeah, she had a well-known husband as well, I'm pretty sure.
Well, she was married to Grant Bovey at the time that Grant Bovey ran off with Anthea Turner, because remember the front page of The Sun where they're both biting into a bar of chocolate because the chocolate company had sponsored the wedding?
That's right. It was Hello Magazine, wasn't it? Hello Magazine had exclusive rights to the pictures. It was the PR screw-up of all time.
It was definitely. So here they are, celebrating their nuptials and they're in love forever. It's fantastic. And the picture which The Sun lifted from whichever magazine it was, which one was
that? Hello Magazine.
Hello. Put it on the front page. It made
Hello,
them look,
Michael.
Yeah, exactly. And it made them look like the biggest bunch of let's cash in jerks forever, didn't it?
Well, it really did. And they really were. Sorry.
Right. Well, there you go. But I remember one particular aspect of the story, because it ran for about a week, Grant Bovey's run off, Della Bovey's not going to take this. And then she goes off to Switzerland or somewhere, believe it or not, and has another newspaper on her side, if you see what I mean. It was Tabloid Wars and all that kind of stuff, And she's sitting on the top of somewhere like, Mount Everest or something, which is not in Switzerland.
Mount Everest in Switzerland, you mean? Not that Mount Everest.
But whichever is the biggest mountain in Switzerland, like Mont Blanc or something like that, And, what is the biggest mountain in Switzerland? I can't remember now. Anyway, the point is,
I wouldn't like to hazard a guess. No, Mount Everest is in Switzerland.
That's right, yeah. But anyway, she's got this glass of champagne celebrating, I've got Grant back. So the opposition newspaper, could have been the Daily Mirror or the Daily Star or something, is saying, no, she's back with Grant. And then the classic was that there's a party that night and Della goes into the party with a slinky red dress and does the complete faux pas for the woman who's been cast aside and tells the DJ, play I Will Survive.
Oh, no. Dear. Yeah. Well, that's every woman's karaoke song, isn't it, really?
Exactly. Well, every cast aside woman's karaoke song, I suppose, but there you are.
Oh, dear. Well, anyway. No. So, look, poor Anthea ends up with Mark Armstrong. Their wedding has been put back about three times now because of the lockdowns. So I wish them well anyway. I've known them both in the past and Yeah. May this be the right one for both of them, and may they have a very happy rest of life.
Absolutely. I think one thing in favour of Anthea is that, as I understand it, having, you know, kept in touch with the story, as we all do, that Grant Bovey's daughters are still very close to her and thought she was a great stepmother when he was married to them, which I think says something, you know.
Well, they were. I'm not sure they are now, but yeah. They were when they were younger, I know. So.
There we are. Right. OK, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. To all our millions of listeners and subscribers, thank you for joining us today. Take care, folks, in the heat wave. And let's have a thumbs up, please, if you're English, for England. And if you're not, well, Scotland the brave.
And I'm heading, meanwhile, to Switzerland, where I'm going to spend a nice weekend climbing Mount Everest.
You do that. Thank you very much, Miss Jones, and everybody else. Take care. I go out there and I'm working in New York, based in New York, and I have to go over to LA. And I know this sounds pathetic now, 40 years on, but I go and see some correspondent. I think it was John What's-His-Name who worked for The Telegraph.
Well, that narrows it down, doesn't it?
Yeah, it narrows it down enormously. Or it might have been, it was either John What's-His-Name for The Telegraph, or it was Eddie What's-His-Name for Daily Mail or something like that, you know. But anyway. Point of story is, they all had swimming pools, and they like to boast about it. So I go around, see him, and we're on a job together, you know, and I've come over from New York and we're going to make a great series out of this or something like that. And he says, come on, let's go and have a swim. I said, yeah, it'd be lovely, you know. So I'm standing in the middle of the swimming pool. This is a pathetic story 40 years on.
I have just realised.
And she's sitting on the top of somewhere like, you know, Mount Everest or something, which is not in Switzerland.
Mount
obviously.
Everest in Switzerland, you mean? not Mount Everest.
But whichever is the biggest mountain in Switzerland, you know, like Mont Blanc or something like that, you know what I mean? And, what is the biggest mountain in Switzerland? I can't remember now. Anyway, the point is,
I wouldn't like to hazard a guess think Mount Everest is in Switzerland.
That's right, yeah. They roll his trousers up, take his shoes and socks off.
How is Susan Shocks?
Yeah, that's right. How is Susan Shocks? Yeah.